On Tucson Business Radio X now, join Michael Shoup and Carolyn Goldschmidt from HOA Law with another in-depth program and interesting guests with Community Law and your host, Michael Shoup.
Welcome, everyone, to Community Law, live and streaming from the Stewart Title Studio in Tucson, Arizona, our monthly program covering topics and trends in the world of HOAs. We are Michael Shoup and Carolyn Goldschmidt. Hello, Carolyn. How are you?
Good afternoon.
Carolyn and I are Goldschmidt Shoup, the law firm of Goldschmidt Shoup, providing legal services focused on real estate and common interest community law here in Tucson and throughout Southern Arizona. We are happy to be joined today by two guests from the HOA industry, Jeff Lane of Labar Oxney Insurance and Howard Schmitter of HBS Management Solutions to discuss security and liability issues in HOAs. How are you both today?
I'm doing well, Michael. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Jeff?
Thank you, Michael. I'm doing great.
Thanks again for joining us. And Carolyn, I think before we get into some of the meat and potatoes of security and liability issues with our guests, maybe we can do a little groundwork for our listeners and discuss at first the basic nature of what an HOA's duties are.
Well, most homeowners associations have common areas or common elements. So one of the main duties and responsibilities of a board is to maintain, manage, repair, control the common areas and common elements. All associations have governing documents. So the association, through its board of directors, is responsible for upholding and enforcing the provisions of the governing documents, especially the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, the CC&Rs, where the use restrictions are, the restrictions on how property in this particular community can be used. And then the third tier of responsibility is that virtually all homeowners associations are nonprofit corporations. So there are corporate duties, administrative duties, to have regular meetings, keep records, have minutes of the meeting, be responsive to members' questions and needs within reason. And then the last tier is when we talk about explicit, implied, and assumed duties, which is going to be a big part of our discussion today, that an association through its board can actually take on more liability exposure than the association has by taking on duties that are not within the legal responsibility of an association.
Okay. And when we talk about duties, is that just maybe a fancy legal word for responsibility, something the association is responsible for doing?
Well, a duty is a legal requirement, and a responsibility flows out of the duty. You have a responsibility to govern and manage in a certain way, to meet your legal duty of being prudent, vigilant, and reasonable.
Okay. And when you hear the term responsibility or duty, is that the same thing as liability? I think we hear from homeowners and from our volunteers in our communities, they're very concerned about liability.
Well, I think you'll agree that most of the legal opinions we get asked for start with, do we have liability for this or that? And liability is very much a legal notion, and it means that the accused or alleged person or organization that is liable fell below their standard of care in meeting their responsibilities. So liability is when something goes wrong, the people who are injured, damaged, or upset look at who is to blame, who is liable for this problem.
And it all stems from what responsibilities or duties that entity or individual had to begin with, and did they meet those responsibilities or not?
Exactly. So that with our discussion today about security and safety, I think the opening discussion is, what is an association's duty and responsibility in terms of the security of its members and residents? And how can an association go beyond what it's responsible for and therefore assume liability?
Right. And I think with that, we'll go to you, Howard, with kind of that question. What kinds of security, what kinds of safety issues or precautions does an HOA need to be paying attention to?
And I think before Howard launches in to an answer, maybe tell us a little bit about your company and how you know so much about security, because we know you do.
Well, HBS Management Solutions is made up of really four different companies. The HBS Management Solutions is a company that's managing HOA associations. And then we have HBS Property Services, that in that world, we take care of people's homes when they're not there. We happen to have a lot of snowbirds in communities that we manage. And at the same time, we have a concierge service built on top of that where we have pool maintenance and landscaping and things like that. Whatever the needs of the client are, that's what we try to take care of. We also have a company called Arizona Automated Entry Systems. And that starts to fall in with what we're talking about, where we're installing RFID systems for residents to gain admittance into communities. And this is also, we install a closed circuit television. So what we're trying to do with that is to combine the closed circuit television and the RFID system. So when people are coming in, we're reading a license plate and it identifies who they are. We have cameras showing who they are. So it's a controlled access point. And that's a difference than having a secured world where there are no walls around the HOAs. It's all the controlled access point and making sure who's coming and going should be there and have the permission of homeowners that live there. You can have people that come on a regular basis, housekeepers, pool maintenance people, landscapers, any number of people that are coming and going on a regular basis. But then there's also sometimes there's deliveries being made. Just because somebody says they've got going to a house, we want to make sure that in fact that they are. And that's another one of the secured points there, that if a homeowner hasn't called a gatehouse that we manage and told us that somebody's coming out of the normal, we check with that homeowner when that person arrives to make sure that they are the people that they expect. But if nobody's answering the phone, we don't let them just come in either. So that's one point of security with a manned gatehouse. There are other communities that we manage that have gates, but they're strictly run off of these RFID systems to allow people in and out. There's nobody there checking people in or out, but they're there to keep people out that don't live there for the most part. The other things that happen in that world are services during the nighttime, where we are doing inspections of communities to make sure that all is well and there are not people walking around that should not be there. The way we tell our people that work for us is that they're to observe and report. And if they see something like that, they keep the eyes on the person, they will call 911 and just stay with that person until the police arrives. We're not there to apprehend anybody or confront them. That could end up in a bad situation, so we don't want to do that.
Right.
So there's many ways that you can initiate the controls.
Well, and it sounds like what you're describing is, and to use some of your words, not a system of walls or barriers, but a system of managing risk. It's having choices of ways in which to anticipate certain risks and have procedures and structures or RFID cameras, things in place to manage that, identify people. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about the controls. And we're trying to control the environment that people coming and going into a community. That's what's important. Writing people's names down, listing what they're driving, or should they or should they not be in there. But it's all about control points. And that's what helps. Those tools are what we talk about, cameras and RF. Those are the tools of the control.
Right. Now, in your experience in that way, do you have clients or communities that maybe ask for more than that? Maybe they ask for patrols or even the service, I guess you could call it a community-type law enforcement body.
There are communities that do ask for us, as I was talking about a minute ago, to drive around the neighborhood during the night to make sure that everything is buttoned up. If they have clubhouses, fitness centers, swimming pools, we want to make sure they're locked. We want to make sure that if a swimming pool has posted hours, that if the pool's supposed to be closed at 10 or 11 at night, we don't find parties going on at 2 or 3 in the morning. So those are the things that we check to make sure that are okay. People hanging around in a parking lot at 2 o'clock in the morning, we need to find out what they're doing.
Right.
Then people have neighborhood watches, too, that just the community itself forms to keep an eye on what's going on. And that's a participation of people that live there watching what's going on and reporting it as well. They could call the police. It just is, you know, we encourage people to call the police before they call us because they're going to get there first.
Which is an important liability concern, that the neighborhood watch is not a committee of the board. It is not controlled by the association. It's strictly a neighborhood group that usually works directly, here in Tucson with the sheriff or the police department, that has their own outreach to help organize.
Right. Because we don't want to be forming a group of people that act like they're law enforcement when in fact they are not. These people are just to observe what's going on and then report to the police department if they think something's wrong. And we encourage people, look, just because you're not sure, but if you think there could be a problem, call. Let the police department sort it out. That's what's the proper thing to do.
Now, Jeff, I'll go to you real quickly. When you hear these scenarios of security in a community, what are some of the kind of the risk bells that are going off in your head from an insurance perspective of what risks come with monitoring access to a community?
Right. Well, from an insurance perspective, in Labar Oxney, we were formed 35 years ago with the sole purpose of insuring community associations. We don't insure anything else. We have a lot of experience with community associations and the risks they face. Security is generally looked upon by insurance carriers as a good thing because they do things, like Howard said, chase away potential vandals, loiterers, people who do not belong in the community. They make sure the pool gates are locked up and in good condition. But it also brings a different kind of risk, and that's when you see communities that select armed patrol. And armed patrol is one of the biggest fears that insurance carriers have. As a matter of fact, we work with dozens and dozens of insurance carriers as an independent broker. I know of only one who will even insure a community who uses armed guards, and that includes off-duty law enforcement. Just because a vendor with a gun, regardless of their training, brings a whole lot of risk and potential liability that we discussed. So whenever a community is even entertaining the idea of armed patrol or off-duty law enforcement, we encourage them to check with their insurance agent first.
And, you know, this tension that I kind of, you know, am starting to feel with these choices of finding the right level of security and maybe some financial pressures that come along with that. Security, Howard, I have to assume, comes with some kind of expense.
Yes, it does. It's dependent on what level that a HOA wants to have in their community. There are obviously, the more that you do, the expense is greater. Having people driving around the community, it costs so much money to put somebody in a vehicle and have them on the streets. Having a gate attendant 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there's a cost associated with that. Just not the people. You've got a gatehouse, you've got the equipment, the cameras, the gate arms or gates themselves. There's a lot of different moving pieces here that all have a cost associated with it.
Now, how do you, with your clients, how do you navigate those choices with them? How do you pinpoint kind of the things that are going to be most helpful for their community?
Well, in board meetings, they'll discuss at what level do they want to have these things and what are the risks associated with those things and what are the positives associated. What is it that we're trying to do here? Okay, you have to make a decision on exactly what it is that you're trying to get accomplished. And so then you start developing this plan on how to implement all those things. And we, in my company, will give them multiple choices, so to speak, but there's also multiple price points for all that. So then they're picking what is good for them and what they can feel reasonably sure that they can afford and maintain going forward. Because you don't want to put things in and take them out, put them, you know, whatever, because of cost. We want to try to be very consistent all the time. Because you're building in an expectation. The people that live there will now expect this and this and this. And you want to make sure you're delivering all the time.
Right. And on that point, Carolyn, is there guidance in Arizona law as where that balance is?
There is, but Howard brought up a very important word, expectation. And what I see is that in the business of managing security, which is a word we don't even like to use, but managing surveillance, patrols, control, managing the homeowners, the residents' expectations is really important because owners, particularly if there's a gate, owners then have an expectation that they're going to be protected in their homes.
Right.
And the association's duty is in the common area to control and make safe the common area. And we do have a case in Arizona called Martinez versus Woodmere Condominiums. And it was a number of years ago, I think in the late 90s, that the Arizona Supreme Court decided this case. And the storyline is that Carlos Martinez wasn't a resident. He was an attendant at a graduation party. And this condominium was in a not-so-great section of Phoenix, a higher crime area. And there was some gang-related assembly in the parking lot. And Mr. Martinez wound up getting shot and injured. And the association got sued. And initially, the court, the appeals court and trial court, found that the association had no duty to Mr. Martinez because he was a guest. The Supreme Court threw that out and said that the association's duty flows through the owner to tenants, to guests. So that was a non-starter. But they focused on the association's liability as a possessor or controller of property. And they found a duty on the part of the association, similar to a landlord with common areas, to keep the common areas reasonably safe. So that meant, and it mostly means from a maintenance point of view, you don't want to have raised sidewalks in the common area or tree roots or trees that are going to fall over on cars or things like that. But it was also extended to known dangerous conditions. And the testimony showed that there'd been loitering and assembling in this parking lot for quite a while, there was a paid security guard that actually lived in the community, and they had double shifts. And because of budgetary constraints, they did away with the early shift and only had a late shift, and this shooting occurred at 6:30 at night. And interestingly, the Supreme Court had no sympathy for the budget of an association. They didn't buy that, well, we just don't have the money for this.
So where does that leave an association? Is there a threshold where they have to, I mean, where does that move the bar when they say, well, our initial idea is we look at our budget, we don't have the money for this. Does this case then mean that's not good enough? You need to look for that money or adjust your expectations.
Well, you know, for example, we have a few clients that are not gated, and they go through a debate almost annually, should we gate our community? And it's so interesting to me that when the members weigh in, a lot of them don't want a gated community. And other ones do, and then there's some upset about who's going to benefit more and are we paying more money for some people. So it's very hard to gate a community after the fact, number one. And where that leaves us is that the boards should focus on the common area. And one of the biggest questions I see all the time, because the expectations of members, I can't tell you how many residents will see something not right, and they'll call their manager. They will not, or their president. They will not call 911. So that shows their expectation is that the association has a very far-reaching responsibility to them in their homes, in their cars, at their homes, and things like that.
We experience that all the time, that people will call us. I mean, if they were witnessing a crime, they will call us instead of calling 911. And obviously, we're going to go see what's going on. But we always tell people, always, please call 911 first. That is the most important thing you can do. And I can't stress that enough.
So one of the conundrums I hear all the time is the duty to inform. Because members, I can't tell you how many times this happens. A member or a resident calls saying there's yelling and screaming next door to me. And I'm worried they have a gun and, you know, the police have been here 3 weeks in a row. And then they're very irate that the whole community isn't being told of this problem. So from a legal point of view, I think the duty is to warn of a dangerous condition in the common area. That the association, people have certain privacy rights. If there's some kind of domestic violence or problem within the home that the police is dealing with, does the association have a duty to let the entire neighborhood know?
Well, I wonder if maybe a particular situation. I mean, I think if there were a flood in a unit, let's use a condominium as an example, and there was a flood in a unit that affected the common elements of the building, I think that becomes much more of an easy question to decipher, that I think there would be a duty to inform the other residents in the building, because now you have the common elements that are around all of their units being affected. But I think Carolyn's question is interesting, because what if it's questionable whether or not activity in a unit actually affects the common elements, which goes back to the question of rules and regulations to protect and control the common area or the common elements. Have there been instances, maybe Jeff, you've seen some instances where an activity becomes large enough that it starts to blur the lines and starts to become a community issue, and the association then was in a position where they had to defend the fact that they didn't inform other residents?
Gosh, Yes, I do recall a situation where there was an actual burglar living in a community. And it was a gated community, as a matter of fact. It was one of the children who was living at home with their parents. And the board became aware of that, but he was a minor and they had some issues. And they sought some legal advice. And the legal advice was you can give them just what's available from the local police department. And so they started publishing crime statistics. But when people called, say, give me specifics, where does this guy live? What are you doing about it? They really felt like their hands were tied. And the homeowners really felt that the board wasn't serving them adequately and threatened lawsuits against them, right, which later became a director's and officer's liability claim.
Carolyn, you and I had a situation a while back with a dog bite, a dog attack that had occurred on common area. And the crux of that issue was, again, it wasn't a physical condition on the common area. It wasn't something of protecting the common area, but it got turned very quickly into who had knowledge of what condition on the property, what activity. And what had occurred in this case was two dogs owned by owners in the community were known by various directors to be able to escape from the property and to be seen out in the property, and to at least one of the directors known to be unfriendly. But the board did not take formal association action other than to send a letter to the owner of the dog saying, your dogs can't be out in the common area without a leash. And they figured that it was done at that point. And unfortunately, what transpired was the dogs on one of their occasions getting out got tangled with an elderly owner and caused her severe injury. And all of a sudden the question came to who had knowledge of what, when, and what did they do about it? And an interesting question that came up was the individual director's knowledge, is that imputed? Does that transfer to the corporation, to the association? And unfortunately, that interesting question never got ruled on in the case we were involved in. It was a case that got settled. But I think that that plays into this role a little bit. If a director knows about a situation, in my personal opinion, maybe I think there's a duty, a responsibility at least, to inform the other directors so that the association can make some kind of determination. I don't know.
Particularly in that case, these were pit bull dogs that are known to have a propensity to be dangerous. And the neighbor was the president of the association. And she knew that the dogs got out regularly. So I think at that point, she did have a duty that some sort of violation letter should have gone to the owners to keep their dogs better restrained, because the association was involved in that problem simply because the attack took place on the common area. So they had the duty as the possessor of and controller of the land. But this attack had nothing to do with a dangerous situation on the property. It was the failure to restrain a vicious dog.
Right.
There are similar issues in gated communities with private streets, because when they become private streets, they also become common area.
Right.
And then when you have people running stop signs, exceeding speed limits, breaking laws that would be strictly enforced out on city streets, well, the expectation of a homeowner is, what are you going to do about these people that are endangering us, our children, whatever? So, you have to make sure that in those gated areas and those private streets, you've got proper signage, your lanes are marked, your stop bars are there. All those things come into play, because if you don't do that, somebody's going to have you in a courtroom saying, why don't you do that? Why did you? When you particularly knew that there would be a problem?
Well, you are listening to Community Law on Tucson Business Radio with Goldschmidt Shoup, and I think we're having a really interesting conversation regarding the responsibilities and duties that come along with control over common property. And Howard, you were just mentioning this issue of gated communities come along with more private areas to control, speeding issues, things like that. And something you had mentioned before was this idea of observe and report. And I think that was in the context of don't become personally involved in a dispute, just observe and report. And I wonder if this has a tie, Carolyn, to the idea of assuming additional responsibilities. If an association or a board says we're going to have a patrol in our community, does what that patrol observes come with a responsibility to report to the board? And is there some liability exposure if what they see isn't reported and the board doesn't do something about it?
Well, again, I think it depends on whether the problem is observed in the common area or if the patrol happens to see someone in a hoodie on a bicycle driving to the backyard of a dark house. I think, again, managing expectations is really important. And I think as a threshold matter, it behooves the board and possibly their manager to communicate to the members what the association's responsibility is and what they will do, and to make it clear that owners, residents, are really responsible for their own security and their own safety, and that we're going to do what we can on a community-wide basis to secure the common areas and let you know what's going on in the common areas. You might even, you know, there is nothing wrong with a board reporting crime statistics, so members are aware of what's likely to happen. I know many associations do that, and some members object. They think that you're needlessly scaring people or alarming them. But then there are the other people who are saying, well, you know, you have this information. You need to share it with us. Right. But there needs to be a reiteration of what the duty is and what the association will do.
Well, I think we'll take just a little break here. We can talk a little bit about our firm, give a little plug for ourselves here just before we move on with the conversation. Carolyn and I at Goldschmidt Shoup have about 40 years combined experience representing approximately 400 community associations and cooperatives of all sizes and demographics throughout Southern Arizona. Our small, dedicated staff is committed to efficient, effective, and economical legal representation. Whether you have questions about covenant enforcement, have governing documents that may be overdue for revisions and updates, or have a few assessment delinquencies in your community, you can expect that Goldschmidt Shoup will provide quality advice and practical solutions. Carolyn, just to piggyback a little bit off of what you were just saying, a question that comes up with expectations, and you mentioned reporting of crime statistics. I guess people convicted of sexual crimes and things like that comes up. There's a registry for sex offenders and things. I think we often get questions about when an association learns about that, do we have a responsibility to notify? Is that kind of within the same discretionary area?
Well, it certainly comes up because tier 4 sex offenders need to register. And if they move into an area, the sheriff or police has a duty to notify all of the residents within a specified geographic area. And every time the notice goes out to a homeowners association, the phone starts ringing in the manager or board members' homes or offices about, well, there's a sex offender here. What are you going to do about it? And here's an area where the association needs to tread carefully so they're not taking on more responsibility. In general, unless the association has a CC&R provision prohibiting tier three or four sex offenders from living in the community, there's nothing the association can do about it as far as leaving them out. And then the question becomes, should associations have that type of restriction? Personally, I don't like it because I think it would be very hard for the association to enforce. And if something terrible does happen, then now the association's liable for not enforcing its own restriction. So I believe that sex offender issues are better left to law enforcement. There is a duty to register. There's a duty to inform. And associations need to tread carefully because if they don't have a duty and they start spreading information about a resident who's believed to be a sex offender, here too they could be taking on liability if they're wrong.
Right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit back to you, Jeff. Maybe take just a minute. Tell us a little bit more about LeBar Oxney Insurance and we can ask some more questions.
Absolutely. Personally, I've been with LeBar Oxney. I came to Southern Arizona in 2006. And prior to that, I was actually a community manager. So I worked on the management side for 14 years until I had the opportunity to come to Arizona from California and work with LeBar Oxney. As I said before, we're an independent broker, which means we don't work for a carrier. We work for the community association. We have access to dozens and dozens of insurance programs and carriers. Because not one, there isn't just one policy that fits all communities. You know, as we've been talking about today, there's lots of different types of communities and different functions for each community. So we've been around for 35 years. We insure about 6,000 communities now in Western U.S., primarily in Arizona and California.
Okay. Now, Carolyn early on talked about how as attorneys, she and I get asked questions all the time from our clients about what is our liability? And I'm sure you must also get asked that question.
Daily.
And from an insurance perspective, is that the right question?
No, it isn't. And I always pre-qualify my answer with, I am not an attorney. Liability is strictly a legal question. Liability is the legal responsibility for property damage or an injury. And the only person who can determine legal liability is the court, pretty much. What I deal with is risk, and risk is different than liability, and the risk is the probability of something ending up in a loss, in a injury, in a property damage situation. So that's sort of the difference. They're related, but they're not the same concept, really.
So when you talk about probability of risk or probability of an event occurring, what are the things that you're thinking of when talking to communities?
Well, a good example, we were talking about dog bites earlier, and I get this question quite often. Manager will call me up and says, Jeff, that the association's thinking about putting in a dog park in the common area. Does that increase our liability? I said, well, I'll tell you what, it certainly does add risk. Anytime you add any type of amenity, you're adding some level of risk. And that could be a dog bite. It could also be a homeowner who doesn't like you taking over their common area and spending their association money on a capital improvement that they may or may not want next door to their unit or their home. So that's certainly a risk also. I mean, that's a risk. But because they have a dog park doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be found legally liable or legally responsible for the injury that someone's dog inflicts on someone else or someone else's dog.
So you're talking about risks of bodily harm or injury. I think you were alluding to risks of possibly some directors and officers' liability based on a decision to expend money on a capital improvement. You when it comes to, and maybe I'll shoot over to you, Howard, real quick. If a community came to you and said, we want to put in a dog park, we have a movement among the owners that we want to put in a dog park. Who do we need to talk to? What do we need to consider from a manager's perspective? What do you bring to that question?
One, the location of where it's going to be is going to be very important, because anybody that has to live right beside one may have a very large problem with that. Two, we would obviously call our insurance company and say, what is the risk here? And what does that entail? What kind of problem can that cause us? Because I want the board to make an informed decision. Our job would be to implement whatever decision they make, but they need to make an informed decision, and that's going to be something that Jeff and people like him will give us the answers for, at least the risk assessment anyway.
Okay. I can tell you that the biggest risk that a carrier looks at is the number of homes in a community. That is primarily what drives your general liability premium and directors and officers liability premium, is the number of residents in a community, because that translates to the number of people who can sue you, the number of people who could potentially be injured on the common area. That is by far the biggest driver of premium in a community. So you're just looking at people is the hugest risk. It's not, you know, we think of swimming pools and lakes and skate parks and water slides and things. Those are all risks, but by far the biggest risk is people.
And maybe on that note, you mentioned parks and lakes and pools and things like that. Is there one question that you are just commonly asked over and over again when you meet with boards?
Well, now that we're at the end of monsoon season here in Arizona, and we're all, you know, thinking about the poor folks back in North Carolina right now, tree branches. I would get this call pretty much daily in the summer. A community association tree, a common area tree, fell on someone's car or someone's home, or a common element like a common area fence. Are we liable? Well, no, you're not liable per se. This is called an act of nature. It used to be called act of God. The association is not responsible for that tree falling. It's the wind. So back in North Carolina right now, there's going to be people's trees spread for blocks. They're not going to go find whose tree punched a hole in that person's roof and have them pay for the roof. It's an act of nature. The only time I've seen an association insurance policy pay for a tree damage is when the tree was poorly maintained. It was dead, diseased, dying. It had been reported on several occasions, hey, please cut back this tree. I noticed it's got a disease. There's a dead branch hanging over my carport. In which case, the association probably is liable and probably would get a settlement from the HOA policy. But in almost every other case, they're going to say no. That's why we all have property insurance, to insure our property against acts of nature and other types of accidental damage.
Well, and maybe we can parse that out a little bit. You mentioned, the Carolinas at the moment with what is heading their direction. From a standpoint of disaster preparedness, you talk about risk. What are, and maybe translate it here to monsoon season, what are the types of activities that an HOA needs to be anticipating, be expecting, so as to avoid the problems and then be able to say, if something does happen, it was out of our control?
Sure. In terms of preparation, that really isn't an insurance subject, but we discuss it a lot in risk management. There are organizations. The local fire department is a great resource. The Red Cross is a great resource to help a community plan for things like evacuation. What happens when there is no power and the gates don't open? What happens when we need to get fire resources in and get people out on the same skinny road, on the same skinny gate? And it really helps to have a plan and create that with local law enforcement, with the fire department, with the Red Cross. They'll help you create a plan and then publish it to the members. and remind the members this is what happens. You know, I have communities in brush areas or forest type areas that right before fire season, they publish this plan. They have a website. They remind residents to go check out the website. This is the emergency evacuation plan. And then after the fact, make sure you've got the right insurance. Make sure you've got adequate insurance. Make sure the association is insuring the right things, and make sure you're prepared for the cleanup and eventual rebuilding.
And I would call that liability avoidance by being responsible and taking steps to inform and educate. So then after the fact, there isn't a question of whether the association did enough.
Buffalo grass, kind of a hot button issue in our neck of the woods. And particularly during fire season, it seems that one of the big concerns about buffalo grass, other than just being this virulent encroaching, weed, is that it dries and creates a fire hazard. Have you been involved in maybe some risk management or liability avoidance practices of associations, or have you been asked after the fact about buffalo grass?
I've actually been involved in directors and officers liability lawsuits where someone has sued an association for not removing different species of plants, and not just buffalo grass, but it might be a certain species of tree in the common area for which someone is allergic, and they demanded the association remove a tree. But with buffalo grass, yes, it's terribly invasive, and it's also a fire hazard. In the association, we mentioned before, one of the duties of an association is to make sure people have a safe place to live and to eliminate dangerous or potentially dangerous conditions on the common area. So absolutely, I would certainly work with their insurance agent, the local fire authority, and your landscaper to make sure that this is controlled or at least addressed, and let the residents know what you're doing about it.
Another issue that comes up along those lines is the nervous owner who sees buffalo grass in the common area. Maybe it's a very rural community. There's a lot of open area, but this owner is concerned about whether the association is properly taking care of buffalo grass. What can a board do to lessen their exposure? What's the prudent thing to do? One thing that occurs to me is maybe have the fire marshal come and assess and direct, rather than, on the one hand, the owner might want you to denude all the common areas to keep them safe. And then the board is worried about their budget and being overly zealous. So getting expert advice about what should we do will help meet that standard of care.
Well, and that brings up an interesting question about communities that have common area that are meant to remain natural. And I don't know, maybe Howard, you have some communities that have natural open space areas.
Many.
And, you hear about buffalo grass, you hear about pack rat nests, things like that. Have you dealt with those issues on how you navigate leaving natural area natural, but at the same time addressing owners' concerns about dangerous conditions?
In a lot of the communities where we do have natural open space, and you may have a lot that, in the foothills particularly, you may have a lot that's 5 acres, but you've got about 3.5 of it that's natural open space, and that may butt up against streets. So what we do is that the association tends to take care of 10 to 15 feet off of that street. Then you go back to the homeowner or the lot owner, in this a lot of instances it's undeveloped, and we talk to them about removing those things. But in the common area, we're on that all the time. We got to make sure that those are clear and that there's none of those items in there for all the reasons that we've just talked about.
Right. Well, I think we're coming near the wrap up here. Again, everyone out there listening, you're listening to Community Law live and streaming from the Stewart Title Studio here in Tucson, Arizona. As we wrap up the show, I think it's important for Carolyn and I just to remind everybody, a bit of a disclaimer. You've heard a lot of information today. It's important to remember that the information shared on this show is not, nor is it intended to be, legal advice. And no attorney-client relationship is intended or created between the listeners and Goldschmidt Shoup. If you're interested in seeking specific advice or legal representation from Goldschmidt Shoup, you may contact us at our office at 520-265-4462 or by email at office@gshoalaw.com. You can also visit our website at www.gshoalaw.com, where you can learn a bit about our firm, our services, and soon we'll be able to listen to these broadcasts brought to you by Tucson Business Radio and Business Radio X. Where I'd like to leave off is to give Carolyn a little bit of time to give us a last word on our topic today. Go ahead, Carolyn.
Well, I for me, the theme of this topic is the fact that liability comes when an association does something, and I'll say this in quotes, wrong, falls below the standard of care, doesn't meet their duties in the common area, and possibly a duty to inform the members when there's a known danger in the common area. It is very important that a board or manager for the board does not take on responsibilities that are beyond the scope of their legal duties. It's helpful to know that a plaintiff in a lawsuit that's alleging that an association's security measures were inadequate must demonstrate, one, that the association had a duty to provide whatever security measure the owner thinks should have been in place, and that the association failed to take reasonable steps to fulfill those obligations. So the board needs to manage and inform the expectations of the residents. The word security shouldn't be used to describe the association services. We talk about courtesy patrols, surveillance, safety, a safety committee rather than a security committee. Nothing, again, that would give the owner an expectation that the association is protecting them in their home or protecting their property on their lot or unit. For example, boards that decide to install security cameras or closed-circuit TVs should describe their purpose as surveillance, not security. Security would imply that the camera provides a measure of protection. But cameras simply record crimes. They do little, if anything, to prevent them. And there was a wave for a while of associations putting dummy cameras up when the technology was more expensive. Now it's certainly much more affordable and available. But there have been cases where I remember a case in California where a woman was attacked in a garage and she saw a security camera and actually stopped struggling because she thought someone would see it and come and help her. So no dummy cameras and just no action to give owners the wrong idea about what the association's role is.
Right. Well, we've said it. It's risk management. It's risk understanding. It's risk expectations. And with that, I want to thank particularly Carolyn. Thank you very much for joining me again. Thank you to our guests, Jeff and Howard. And with that, we will wrap up our show for today. Thank you, everybody. This has been Community Law, again, streaming live and broadcasting from the Stewart Title Corporation headquarters in Tucson, Arizona. Thank you, everyone.